Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com, accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast, coming to you from Montecito, California. Before we begin with today's show, I got to tell you, I am super excited about our next event, our next Wealth Formula meetup. And I'm going to tell you why. Because in addition to the usual finance talks that we have, and we're going to have some of old and some new, we've got Tom Wheelwright, Doug Laudmel, but we've also got a guy who formerly ran a sovereign wealth fund, and we also have an MIT-trained scientist who's an expert on basically cheap energy for Bitcoin mining, and that is something that I think is going to be really cool. However, in the afternoon, usually we go for these bus rides, and of course, that is very useful, particularly if you want to see some of the properties that you're invested in. However, I also know that there are people who've been on many bus rides and would like to potentially do something else. So what we have done is actually put an afternoon program together, and an afternoon program that actually involves not personal finance, but something that really all of us are interested in, which is longevity and lifespan. Basically, how to live longer and, you know, better during that time that you actually live. Now, the reality is a lot of people don't know that there are things today that can make you live longer and, you know, healthier for a longer period of time. But there's a ton of technology coming out there beyond just the cardiovascular stuff. And the reality is that right now, I believe that the first person to live to 150 years has already been born. Now, that may not be us middle-aged folks, but I do believe that there's an opportunity for us to live up to 100 and feel like we're 50. The science is compelling, and that's what we're going to talk about in the afternoon. We have some really good speakers that are within our network, some physicians, and it is going to be, it's going to blow your mind, especially if you've not heard much about this stuff. Sign up now, wealthformulaevents.com. We always cap these events at 100 people. It's basically less than a month away now, October 7th and 8th in Dallas-Fort Worth. Again, wealthformulaevents.com. Now, as far as today's show, what we're going to talk about is free trade in the World Trade Organization, right? And when I was growing up, in terms of political affiliation and parties, you know, the Republican Party stood for small government, free trade. The Democrats were apparently on the other side of the table. And maybe it's an incorrect generalization, but, you know, as a child of the 80s and a Reagan Republican, one thing's for sure, neither party supports real free trade anymore. They just don't. Why? Well, I think it stems from an overriding trend towards nationalism. However you feel about the nationalism, you know, I don't tend to think of it as a very good thing. The problem is this interference with free trade, because free trade is very beneficial for economies. And over the past decades, no other country has benefited more from free trade than the United States. There are many benefits to free trade. Obviously, you have a greater variety of goods to choose from. Free trade allows for maximization of resources and makes them more efficient to allocate. Also, promotes efficiency in production, improves employment. Now, some people are like, oh, no, but, you know, it doesn't improve employment because it takes jobs away from the Midwest. Now, that if you look at the numbers, the net effect is it improves employment. And finally, it allows us to keep the cost of stuff we consume way lower than it would be if we didn't have free trade. Just imagine where we'd be if we didn't have China, right? I mean, and we'd be paying a lot of money for clothes and, you know, pretty much everything else that we have. The body that regulates global trade is the World Trade Organization. And as you can imagine, these nationalistic forces that I'm talking about have rendered it less effective than it was. Now, to discuss the benefits of free trade and the health of global trade today, I have the opportunity to speak with one of the founders of the World Trade Organization, Congressman James Baucus, and we're going to have that conversation right after we come back from these messages. Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com. Welcome back to the show. Again, today my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Professor James Baucus. Professor Baucus is the Distinguished University Professor of Global Affairs and Director of the Center of Global Economic and Environmental Opportunity at the University of Central Florida. He was also a congressman as well in Florida from 1991 until 1995. And during that time, he was a founding judge and twice chairman, the chief judge, one of the highest court of the World Trade Organization, the appellate body of the World Trade Organization. Professor Baucus, welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be here, Buck. I'm a big fan of yours, and it's an honor to be asked to be on your show.
Well, that's very kind of you. You know, we have a bunch of very smart listeners, but a lot of us don't know very much about, you know, the global economy and trade and that sort of thing. So maybe we can start with this this time when you were in the Congress. And you and your colleagues put together the World Trade Organization. I guess it would be a good idea for us to just talk about sort of what the circumstances were during that time, you know, how things worked before that ultimately led to the need for this organization and what exactly its goals were.
I was trade negotiator for the United States before I became a member of Congress. I was the first former trade negotiator for this country, later to serve in the Congress, unless we count John Quincy Adams, who had far more achievements overall than I have had. A great admirer of President Adams. Therefore, even as a junior member of the Congress, I was much involved on trade issues in the early 1990s. I was a strong proponent of the NAFTA. I was much involved in the effort to get China permanent normal trade relations status, what we call in the trade world most favored nation status. And I was one of the six original co-sponsors in the House of the implementing legislation for the Uruguay round of trade agreements that did many things, but among them concluded all the various agreements that together comprise the WTO treaty, and also established the World Trade Organization as an international institution. But this was not something we created from nothing. In the aftermath of the Second World War, leading countries came together and created the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which had created a rule-based trading system that had lasted for nearly half a century before it was transformed into the WTO. What we did with the WTO is vastly broaden the scope of what had been the GATT. And also, we made the rules in the agreement binding. Our challenge in 1994 in bringing the United States into the WTO was that we wanted to discern ways to continue to free trade worldwide while also making the rules of trade binding on everyone, not only the United States of America. The theory is that in lowering barriers to trade worldwide, we can vastly increase the amount of trade worldwide and thus increase the economic gains from trade for each individual country. And then each country can, in its own domestic deliberations, decide how best to distribute those gains domestically through tax policy, through other forms of domestic policy. And that's exactly what we succeeded in doing with the WTO. More than a quarter of a century later, the Bertelsmann Foundation in Germany has recently concluded a study of the extent to which all the 164 countries that are members of the WTO now have benefited from being a part of this multilateral trading system. They found that every single one of those countries benefited economically, and they found that the country that benefited the most was the United States of America. So this has been a very worthwhile endeavor from the point of view of Americans, but also from the point of view of everyone else.
What about when you talk about everyone in the World Trade Organization, you're including obviously China and Russia, and you know, in a way, I wonder, because you hear about China breaking rules all the time, it almost seems like a little bit of a little unfair, right? Like we have a set of guidelines that we're going to run by, but you know, they cheat and no one's, you know, they don't get kicked out for it. So in that regard, do you see that as an ongoing project? I mean, how do you view those kinds of situations?
China came into the WTO in 2001, a few years after it was established. And in becoming a member of the WTO, China entered into what is called an accession agreement. And in that agreement, it not only agreed to comply with all the obligations that bound everyone else to the WTO treaty, but also a lot of additional obligations that applied only to China. For the most part, China has kept its obligations. And also, when China has been brought before the bar of justice in WTO dispute settlement, where in the first decade of the WTO, as you mentioned, I was the chief judge, China has largely complied with rulings that went against China. Yet it's true that in many respects, China, which is a huge country of more than a billion people, does not always comply with its WTO obligations. Of course, it should. And in my view, the United States and other countries should join together more often to bring complaints, lawsuits against China in the WTO. Because China has had a good record of complying with WTO rulings when they are adverse to China. Yet the size of China and the recent shift of China away from more open markets and a more open economy and society and back toward an inwardness creates a continuing problem for the other members of the WTO in dealing with China within the trading system. But I'd like to emphasize that it's not only China that does not always comply with all of its WTO obligations. Many other countries do not always comply with them either. The United States has not complied with many of its WTO obligations in the past half dozen years since first Donald Trump was elected, and now under the Biden administration. The unilateral tariffs that were imposed by President Trump and his administration against China are all flagrantly illegal under the WTO treaty. Some of the other unilateral measures that were taken by the Trump administration against even some of our allies were equally illegal. Right now, there are more than half a dozen cases pending against the United States relating to these Trump tariffs and unilateral measures of other kinds imposed by President Trump that the United States is likely to lose. This isn't mentioned very often in the media, but those cases are there and they're moving toward a conclusion. In my view, every country that's a member of the WTO, every country that signed the WTO treaty should always fulfill all of its obligations. I'm committed to the international rule of law, and that's precisely what the international rule of law requires.
You know, part of what's going to make this work, obviously, is the interest in world trade in general. And, you know, you look around the world, starting with the United States, and you talk about sort of the shifting politics in President Trump's foreign policy. There's an increasing amount of nationalism, not only here, but in other countries, that is creating more of maybe an insular approach. And so I'm curious on if you feel that the World Trade Organization in some regards is in trouble, or if it's not as effective now because of that sort of overall switch in global nationalism.
And nationalism is dangerous. It leads to war, it leads to death, it leads to destruction. The history of the past two centuries proves that. I distinguish nationalism from patriotism. Patriotism is love of country. Nationalism is the belief that your country is the only country and that other countries should step aside. And yes, therefore, economic nationalism is a threat to the WTO, but it's incumbent on all members of the WTO to fight back against economic nationalism. In pursuit of economic nationalism, members of the WTO will take measures that discriminate in favor of domestic producers and suppliers, and these measures are many times inconsistent with their obligations under the WTO treaty. When that happens, other countries should take them to WTO dispute settlement, and they should pay the price in dispute settlement. If a country loses a case in dispute settlement, it has a choice. It can comply with the ruling by eliminating or fixing whatever measure, law, regulation, practice has been challenged, or it can suffer economic sanctions, and those sanctions can be to the tune of billions of dollars annually in lost trade. The reason why the WTO is so controversial is because the WTO is the only international institution that has the leverage and therefore the power to impose its rules, to make certain that the rule of law is upheld. I believe that the WTO can be an effective tool for fighting back against economic nationalism. Let me add, too, that economic nationalism is wholly misguided in terms of economics. Economic nationalism does not help the people of whatever country is practicing it. It hurts them. It diminishes their choices. It increases the prices that people have to pay. It reduces the competitiveness of their industries. Protectionism is another name for economic nationalism. Protectionism does not work.
And I should point out that when you were in Congress, you were a Democrat. And so, you know, traditionally the...
Actually, Buck, I'm still a Democrat.
Yeah, right. Well, I didn't want to presume, but people are changing all the time.
I mean, I agree with everything my fellow Democrats in Washington are doing.
Right. Well, I will say, that's probably a good thing to say. You know, one of the things that strikes me is, you know, they're back when you were in Congress. Well, actually, even before you were in Congress, I should say, because Bill Clinton changed things a little bit. But there was the party of, you know, free trade and open global trade, and that was a Republican Party, and the Democratic Party was not as, you know, that was not a major part of their platform. The Clinton administration comes in, and they, you know, they really become sort of a free trade, you know, administration, which was, I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, but this is pretty unusual a shift for a Democrat.
Well, let me correct you just a bit, Harold, sure. History. You're certainly not wrong about President Clinton or Vice mm-hmm. President Gore. Their views on trade very similar to mine, and I can rightly be described as Clinton-Gore Democrat, and all three of us are in favor of freer trade. But it's not the case that before President Clinton went into office, Democrats were largely against freer trade. That happened later, and I think it's certainly true now. But looking back into the 20th century, Woodrow Wilson was in favor of freer trade. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a strong advocate of freer trade. His Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, helped create the trading system. Harry Truman supported it. John F. Kennedy did as well. There was something called the Kennedy Round. President Carter actively and strongly supported the Tokyo Round. And then, as you have already mentioned, Bill Clinton and others came along, including me, who strongly supported the Uruguay Round. The Democrats began to turn against trade in the 1990s, while I was there, but only strongly turned against trade after I left. As for the Republicans, historically, up until a few years ago, they were, to their credit, very much in favor of free trade and international responsibility in trade and multilateralism in trade. But President Trump changed all that. Well, there are still Republicans who support free trade, but for the most part, they're not in the Congress and they're not running for office.
My point in bringing this up a little bit is that there is no real, you know, there's not, neither major party has a significant interest in, you know, free markets and global trade right now. And how does that, you know, how does that bode for an organization like the World Trade Organization?
Well, the United States is the key to the success of the WTO. Trump's continued threats to pull out of the WTO were not helpful to the trading system, nor were his actions in flouting WTO rules, simply ignoring them and going ahead with his bluster and imposing unilateral illegal measures. And right now, I have to say that in my view, the Biden administration is engaging largely in a polite form of protectionism. And they are, for the most part, continuing with President Trump's protectionist policies. They're just not insulting people and yelling about it making a fuss. They're very polite about it, but the policy is pretty much the same.
Again, that's sort of the, you know, that's the point I was making, is that, you know, neither party seems to have a significant interest in.
I think that's true, and indeed it's an understatement. And this puzzles me to some extent, because if you look at any of the polls that have been taken nationally by established polling organizations, they all find that overwhelmingly the American people are in favor of lowering barriers to trade and being engaged internationally and business and commerce. And you find that much of the economic gains that we've seen over the past generation can be attributed to lowering barriers to trade and promoting investment and opening our economy in other ways. The problem is that we should have been doing two things during all that time, and we were only doing one. The one we were doing is lowering barriers to trade, opening up the economy. The one we were not doing was making certain that many of the American people had the skills and the opportunities they needed to be able to succeed in a more open economy. And those are the people who've been displaced. They're largely in uncompetitive industries that continue to exist only because of trade protectionism. They're largely workers who don't have higher levels of formal education. They have needed help in getting through this transition toward a more open, more globalized economy, and they haven't gotten it. And of course, what's happening now is that the people who forgot to help them, both Democrats and Republicans alike, are pointing at the wrong target. They're blaming these consequences on trade when they should be blaming themselves for not providing the opportunities and the broader safety net and the economic help and making a job transition that is necessary. Where we have failed in the United States is making certain that the bountiful economic gains from trade are shared widely among the American people.
Senator, tell us about the book you wrote and why you wrote it.
Well, my latest book is called Trade Links, New Rules for a New World. I am committed not only to trade, but more broadly to sustainable development. I believe and have been working for decades for the environmental, economic, and social goals of sustainable development. I'm much engaged in that still now. The trading system, I believe, and I was there and helped make this happen, was intended at the outset as the very first paragraph in the preamble to the WTO treaty says, to pursue trade and other economic endeavor consistently with the objectives of sustainable development. And here I'm quoting the treaty. And that's exactly what this book is about. It's about how we could change the WTO rules, the provisions in the far-reaching WTO treaty, to make certain not only that trade does not stand in the way of sustainable development, but that trade is an affirmative agent for sustainable development. in the book, I explain why we need to do that. And I also explain how we can do it. I make many specific proposals. And I'm pleased to say that although when I began talking about this after I ceased being a judge on the WTO in 2004, there were no WTO members who were at all interested in what I had to say. Today, 74 WTO members, nearly half of the membership, but accounting for about 85% of all global trade, are actively engaged in what they call structured discussions on the relationship between trade and environmental sustainability. Indeed, I've been speaking with these members and those staffers who are working with them frequently in recent weeks, and I'll be meeting with them in Geneva later this month when I speak at the WTO about Trade Links, my book. And this is a serious amount of progress. Structured discussions in WTO speak are usually a prelude to genuine negotiations that may happen within the next year or so. And they're looking on the environmental front at a number of issues that I talk about in Trade Links that I think need to be addressed. The need to spread technology transfer of new green technologies by eliminating barriers to that trade. The need to address subsidies that cause environmental harms. The need to begin building toward a much more circular economy, such as through disciplining a lot of the environmentally harmful consequences of plastics trade, and also addressing the nexus between trade and climate change, which means trying to figure out how the WTO rules framework can support climate actions when they are genuine climate actions and not stand in the way of them.
The book is, again, Trade Links, Senator James Baucus. The book is available everywhere, right, including Amazon, which is where most of us seem to get our books these days. Is there an Audible book, too?
I'm not sure if there is or not. There may be one already from the publisher, Cambridge University Press.
Got it.
It's certainly available on Amazon, but it's also available on the website of Cambridge University Press, the publisher.
Wonderful. Senator, thank you so much for joining us on Wealth Formula Podcast.
I've enjoyed this chat with you, and I'm happy to come back anytime, Buck. Thanks so much.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. Congressman Baucus is a very smart guy, and you know what I like about him is he's kind of a, you know, old school politician, and you know, kind of, it's not just about party, it's about what's right for the country, and I appreciate his work. Now, before I go, I want to remind you one more time, because spots are limited for our next Wealth Formula event, Dallas-Fort Worth. It's October 7th and 8th, and go to wealthformulaevents.com. Now, remember, this is going to be not only a financial learning experience, but an opportunity to learn cutting-edge stuff when it comes to longevity and health span. That's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.